Call the Senate Tax Committee to order for today, March 5th, 2015. Welcome, members. Thank you for being on time this morning. We are going to start with confirmation. Tax Court Judge Bradford Della Pena. Welcome, Judge. Judge Della Pena, it's been around a year since we saw you last. We welcome you back. If you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and then perhaps give us a little update on what how you view the progress in the tax court. I know that there was a 25% or so increase in funding. There's been a couple law clerks hired. And there had been some discussion about how case management was going and timeliness. So if you could just give us a little update on how you're doing and as you're talking about yourself, we'd appreciate it. Judge Della Pena.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Skoy, committee members, thank you for having me here today. My name is Brad Della Pena. I currently serve as a judge of the Minnesota Tax Court. The tax court elects its chief judge. I was the chief from January 2013 to January 2015. With me today is incoming chief judge Joanne Turner. Governor Dayton first appointed me to the tax court in December 2012 and recently reappointed me this past January. I thank Governor Dayton for the continued opportunity to serve. You will recall that the tax court was in some distress in 2012. I'm happy to report that the current court is timely issuing all of its decisions, has doubled its decisional output as measured by the output in 2011, which is the last time there was a full year of three judges for the entire year. So 2011 compared to 2014, the decisional output of the court has doubled, and that the court has issued thousands of scheduling orders to put every case on its docket on track for timely and efficient resolution. We allow the parties, of course, to seek modifications of scheduling orders when there is reason to do so. But just the issuance of scheduling orders produces the orderly processing of cases. Lawyers do tend to be somewhat deadline-driven, and if you don't give them deadlines, nothing happens. So we have issued thousands of orders creating relatively relaxed timelines, but timelines that we then enforce because having given enough time up front to process the cases to settle them, we will expect good cause if the schedule is going to be lengthened. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned that there was some additional funding. I think the result of that additional funding, and I'll just remind the committee, the tax court had no law clerks at the when we joined. Judge Turner and I joined in early 2013, actually late 2012. You funded law clerks, and I think the increased output in the tax court, and I would suggest also the improved quality of the scholarship and the decisions, is a direct result of the additional funding. The court's major challenge going forward is related to the case processing issue. As I mentioned, we've put all cases on scheduling orders. The major challenge going forward, however, is the court's acquisition of a modern electronic case management system. We have a system. It was written in 1999. It is no longer supported by its manufacturer. It runs on something called Windows XP, which Microsoft stopped supporting years ago. So you have a system that's no longer supported by the company that wrote it, on an operating system no longer supported by Microsoft. And if the system goes down, the potential impact to the court's function would be catastrophic, at least for a time. I think that a failure, I can't say a failure is imminent, but I think given the instability of the operating system and the underlying software, a failure is probably inevitable. I'm happy to report that we have obtained a cost estimate for replacing the case management system from Minute, Minnesota IT. Our request for funding for the case management system is in the governor's budget, and we are currently working with a consultant from Minnit to precisely specify our business requirements. So should the legislature and the governor fund us, we would be ready to go once the funding was in place. You asked me, Mr. Chairman, to say a little bit about myself. I began my career as a public defender, spent 8 years as an assistant state public defender, so I represented persons who had been convicted of crimes and were already in prison. My practice was before the Minnesota Court of Appeals and the Minnesota Supreme Court. I did that for 8 years. I spent 7 years as an assistant Minnesota Attorney General in the Tax Litigation Division. Two of those years, I was the manager of the Tax Litigation Division. My client was Commissioner Bowerly's predecessors. I did that for 7 years. For 5 years, I ran a private practice, solo practitioner in the two areas of law that I mentioned, criminal defense, and this time representing taxpayers before the Commissioner of Revenue and in the tax court. Mr. Chairman and committee members, the court has come a long way during the past 2 years, and I ask for confirmation so that working with my truly exceptional colleagues, we can continue to improve the tax court and to serve the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota.
Thank you very much. Questions, members? Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question. Part of your resume, it said represent individuals and businesses before the Minnesota Department of Revenue and the Minnesota Tax Court, which I think is good. How has that experience impacted your role as a tax court judge now?
Judge Della Pena.
Mr. Chairman, having represented both the commissioner and taxpayers against the commissioner in controversies with the commissioner, I think I can see both sides of tax issues and come from both perspectives. We have an adversary system in which there are stable and conflicting perspectives. And I think having represented parties on both sides, I'm able to view from both perspectives. Ultimately, agency action, which is tested in the tax court, is tested against the statutes written by the legislature, and that's our principal mission. But having both perspectives, I think, allows me, particularly working with my colleagues, to administer the process more fairly.
Anything else? Senator Sanjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Judge. And maybe tagging on to that question a little bit, how would you, in the position that you sit, judge a personal conflict of interest relative to a litigant that might come before the court?
Judge Della Pena.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sanjum, could I ask you to make that a little more clear?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Judge. There may be occasions where a litigant coming before the court might be someone that you had a previous relationship with in some fashion, represented perhaps, who knows. But how would you deal with that, at least in terms of thought? Where is that line, at least in your mind? In terms of a conflict.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sanders.
And I'm not judge suggesting that there ever was. I'm just.
I would recuse. I mean, okay. Recusal is, I think the Minnesota Supreme Court has said that a judge, and judges of the tax court are subject to the canons of judicial standards. A judge must furnish both justice and the appearance of justice. And so I think the line favors recusal in the situation. There are two other judges on the court, presumably neither of whom will have had a relationship with your hypothetical party.
Right.
And I think in order to provide both justice and the appearance of justice, recusal would be my course in that situation.
Thank you.
Anything else, members?
And Mr. Chair, I just have one more, and this is perhaps just taking advantage of an opportunity. from the standpoint of the bench and your position and how you need to at least make decisions about tax and what the meaning of public policy is, perhaps, is there any advice that you could give to the tax committee relative to how it does its work relative to the creation of a tax policy?
Judge Delapena.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sengem, I'm going to disagree slightly with your factual premise.
Okay.
I don't make judgments about tax policy, and that's what I tried to allude to earlier. I measure agency action, whether it's action of the Commissioner of Revenue or action of a county valuing or classifying property against objective standards okay. set forth in legislation. And so I don't actually hold myself out as a policy expert in okay. tax, merely as someone who can read statutes and apply statutes to facts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Judge. I probably need a lesson on tax court.
Thank you. Judge, it's come to our attention in the budget, the governor's request, in addition to the software and the computer updates, there's also a request for a third clerk. Could you talk briefly about that in order for us to understand that and the needs
yes.
there?
I think one way of viewing the tax court is as it was designed to be and functions as a check against the authority of taxing agencies, again, the Commissioner of Revenue and counties valuing and classifying property. The staffers of a court are clerks. Clerks allow us to carefully examine the record in a case to determine the factual material, and they allow us to do comprehensive research. We need staff in order to truly function as an agency independent of the parties. There are instances in which, either through unusual sets of motivations or perhaps lack of competence, we don't get full help from the parties that brief a case. And staff, judicial staff called law clerks, allow us to comprehensively research the law. That promotes our independence and allows us to function more effectively as a check on the taxing authorities.
Thank you. That really probably not part of your confirmation hearing, but good information for us to have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything else, members? Anyone else? Senator Rest?
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee on Taxes recommend that the Senate confirm the appointment of Bradford Delapena as judge of the Minnesota Tax Court.
Senator Rest moves that the Committee on Taxes recommend Bradford Delapena's confirmation to the Tax Court. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Recommend to the Senate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members.
Commissioner Bowerly. Welcome, Commissioner Designee. Pleasure to see you again. A couple months on the job. Had some interesting issues. Turbo tax challenge. Department dealt with it very well. Got things back online. Communication between the Senate and the department is improving and good, very good. Tell us a little about yourself and how your first 2 months have been.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Cynthia Bowerly, and I'm honored to be nominated by Governor Dayton to serve as Revenue Commissioner and to be considered by this committee for confirmation. Although this is not my first opportunity to appear before you, I appreciate the opportunity to share with you a little bit more about myself and the goals for the department as you consider my nomination. I grew up in Benton County, between St. Cloud and Foley on Highway 23. My family instilled in me and my siblings, Dean and Nicole, the values of hard work and giving back to our community, our state, and our nation. My mother, Sharon, worked her way through nursing school. She taught us to care for others and to serve. She was an active volunteer in 4-H, where I spent much of my childhood, and still volunteers at the grade school where my brother and sister and I attended. My dad, Mike, grew up in Foley and served 2 tours in Vietnam as a member of the United States Seabees. He volunteered for that service, and he spent most of his adult life also serving as a volunteer outside of his work life. Upon retirement, he and my mother helped build the first residential hospice house in central Minnesota, Quiet Oaks, in St. Augusta, Minnesota. My uncle, Jerry Bowerly, also served as an important role model for my public service, having served both on the school board and as a member of the Minnesota House of Representatives for District 18B in the late 1980s and early 1990s. After graduating from Cathedral High School in St. Cloud, I attended Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, graduating with a degree in English and Russian and a minor in political science. During and after college, I worked in my family's road construction company. My father and his five brothers built a company, Bowerly Construction, with a couple of trucks starting in the 1960s and grew that company to a large contractor for the state of Minnesota and private entities. They built a great aggregate, asphalt, and concrete company that employed several hundred people. And I spent some of my summer college mornings at 5 a.m. dispatching dump trucks, so maybe not exactly related to tax policy, but I hope you'll appreciate the work ethic that that kind of work can instill. I then attended Indiana University, earning a JD and a master's degree in public policy. While I have worked as an attorney in private practice, most recently at Frederickson Byron here in Minneapolis, I spent most of my career in public service. Along the way, I have drawn on the values I inherited from my family of hard work and fairness and service. From my first job out of college at the National 4-H Center in Washington, D.C., to policy work with the Senate Finance Committee and the Joint Economic Committee of Congress, and serving as 5 years as a commissioner of the Federal Election Commission, these values have served me well. My family roots in Minnesota, my education, and my background provide me with a firm foundation to serve my home state of Minnesota and those who live, work, and raise their families here. I was pleased to join DEED in 2013 as Deputy Commissioner of Workforce Development to work on the pressing needs of building an inclusive and skilled workforce for businesses across Minnesota, and I am honored by Governor Dayton's nomination for this new opportunity to continue to serve. As you know, the department plays a key role in state government. We manage the revenue system and administer state tax laws to fund state programs and service. Our mission is working together to fund Minnesota's future, and we take that work seriously to ensure fairness and effectiveness across the tax system as enacted by the legislature. Since I've been at Revenue, Mr. Chairman, you've noted we've had some exciting things happening. We've done some great work on behalf of Minnesota taxpayers, much of it in close conjunction with this committee. Our work is important and challenging, and it has required steady and flexible leadership and a lot of hard work by employees at all levels of the agency. In 2014, shortly after I arrived at the department, we successfully administered a unique year with two tax bills being signed into law in the middle of income tax filing season. And thanks to the important work of this committee, the 2015 Federal Conformity Bill was passed early this year, and we've already implemented it. Like last year, it allows Minnesota's families and businesses to take advantage of tax benefits. And you are all aware of the recent issues with TurboTax. To address it, we had to make some hard decisions very quickly and in the middle of filing season. I think we can all be proud of the results we achieved to protect Minnesotans and to protect the general fund from potential fraudsters. Finally, we at the department continue to focus on providing excellent customer service. We're committed to communicating in the way that best serves our customers, and our robust outreach efforts are designed to help all taxpayers file and pay what they owe under the law. I want to share one last note with you. Although it's not an everyday occurrence, a few weeks ago, one of our auditors, upon completing an audit with a taxpayer, received a hug. I'm not suggesting to you that everyone is hugging people at the Department of Revenue every day. Many people are not as pleased with us. But that is the kind of customer service that we are building at the department, that our outreach to our business customers and to our individual customers is focused on getting them the information that they need to comply with the law. And I am pleased to be able to lead a department of such high-quality people with such a great reputation, not only among state governments and with you all, but across the nation in terms of our leadership in preventing fraud, protecting taxpayers, and having an innovative tax system. I look forward to any questions, and thank you for your time this morning, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bowerly. Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Bowerly, I have a couple questions. One's easy, one's harder. But what do you think are the most pressing challenges of your department moving forward?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Zelka, I think keeping pace with technology and changes happening in industry and with taxpayers is one of our pressing challenges. We know that there are people who are aimed at hacking the system itself and taking advantage of taxpayers through identity fraud, and making sure that our system can protect not only our system but identify those instances so that we can help protect Minnesotans is one of the things that we are continually focusing on. That takes highly skilled individuals. It takes investments in our system to make sure that we can make those changes and keep our system up to date.
Okay.
Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this one's a little bit tougher, and it's the context is some of the accusations that the IRS had received about how they targeted people, and in Minnesota news within the last 6 months, there's been a commissioner under fire for some things, and this is the background for this question. What do you think is the proper balance between a tax administrator and being an advocate for the executive branch?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazelka, with respect to tax administration, I think the role of the department and of the commissioner is to administer those laws fairly and effectively for as they are written by the legislature and as they appear in the facts of whatever appears before us with respect to the returns that are filed by taxpayers. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there is a role for advocacy in tax administration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bowerly, I appreciate hearing that. I mean, you are in an important, powerful role, and that's exactly what I wanted to hear.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bowerly, we've had this conversation a bit on the side, but you know, if there was one thing I learned from Commissioner Franz when he was in this role, it was the difference between our billboard rate and our effective rate, and you know, the gap between is made up from tax expenditures, which most people outside this room have no idea what they are, but this committee knows that, you know, when we do that, we are actually expending funds for some group. So, you know, the commissioner, I thought, did a great job of spending about 18 months going around the state and helping people understand that impact in the income tax code and also in the sales tax code. And I'm wondering if you have some similar passion, if you see in your time, if confirmed in this role, this idea of the 300 some tax expenditures or deductions we have in code is something that you see helping us look at.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Reinhart, I'm going to suggest that the stool might be put away for a while, but we still have it at the department, and I take to heart your point about getting out and about Minnesota to not only talk to taxpayers directly, but to shed some light on the tax code itself. And I was recently able to be in Rochester, and I'll be joining you in Duluth in the middle of the month. And I look forward to those opportunities to make sure that not only are we having an opportunity to get out and talk to taxpayers across the state and not just ask them to come here to St. Paul, but also to talk about those many issues. And your point about expenditures and their role in the tax system, I think, is one that is not made aware to most people, except for the few months when they are focusing on filing their particular taxes and thinking about those only in the terms of deductions or credits that they may be entitled to, as opposed to thinking about their impact on the whole system. There is, I think, more work for us to do, and happy to continue to work with folks in terms of not only helping explain that to people as I'm out and about, but if there are additional resources the department can provide on our website or other instructional material, informational material, we'd be happy to continue to talk about that.
Senator Thompson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Commissioner Bowerly. I've looked at your resume and listened today, and obviously you've got a varied background and a distinguished career. Do you have any experience at all in specifically as a tax administrator? And if not, how do you plan to try to, learn to gain the tools to do that job, which is, you know, different than other things?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, In my early work in the at the United States Senate, I served as Ms. McQuay or Mr. Sylvia as staff for the Senate Finance Committee, which is the tax policy jurisdiction of the United States Senate. And although I have not been the primary administrator at another revenue agency, I will note that the work of the Federal Election Commission is not unlike some of the work that we do at the Department of Revenue. The campaign finance system is a voluntary filing system, and so outreach and education are important to help people file correctly. When that doesn't happen, the commission has staff engaging in audits, and then that is reviewed through enforcement. And so some of the functionality of the Federal Election Commission is actually quite similar to that of the Department of Revenue. Obviously, the substantive underlying code is different. And I will acknowledge that, you know, in the last, I joined the department in April, and I've had an opportunity to dive into the operational side of it as the deputy commissioner. And this is a new role for me as the commissioner. But I promise you I will work hard to achieve that learning curve and do all I can to serve the department and the committee.
Anything else? Anyone else? Senator Hess. Oh, Senator Senjum. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Byerly. You know, we have a system here of three branches of government, and certainly you represent one of them. We represent another. And yet we do depend on, in this case, this tax committee does depend on your office, your agency, for a lot in terms of information and the administration of frankly, what we do. And so a relationship is probably necessary, and recognizing at times it will be cooperative, but other times it may be somewhat adversarial. But how do you view, if you will, if you've thought about it, your relationship to this committee, to the legislature itself, in terms of servanthood, or not only, if you will, serving your master, but serving this legislative master as well that has to confirm you?
Commissioner Barber.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Senjum, I think that the relationship has to exist on a couple of levels. And first, as on a personal level, I think that I have, as you and I got to know each other as we traveled in Germany a couple of years ago, I think building personal relationships so that you all know that you can call me and you can count on me to deliver information to you. I think the relationship also exists clearly between the committee and the department itself. And there are professional nonpartisan staff at the department and our research divisions who work closely with the staff and provide you all with independent information. And then, of course, with my office and the role that we have in, as you say, in sometimes advocating for a particular bill that the governor has proposed, but always also making sure that you have the information about the administration of the system as you consider policy changes. So I appreciate that sometimes we will not agree, sure. But I always want to make sure that we are in good communication as frequently as is workable for you, and that we are providing you with the best information that we have available.
Good. Thank you.
On the relationship point, I'm pleased with the relationship that we have. I think it's great. I think our relationship with the department is good, and I expect we will, work our way through whatever issues that arise. But I was pleased in your comments that you talked about your relationship with the public, because generally people don't like to pay taxes, and making sure that that's not a painful process is very important. And I would hope that that would really be one of your primary drives, is making sure the relationship with the public is good. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Bowerly, I should have paid more attention to your last name, but I did have the honor of serving with your uncle, and he had a very distinguished career in the Minnesota House while I was there. And so I congratulate you on your family.
Anything else, members? Anyone else? Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee on Taxes recommend the Senate confirm the appointment of Cynthia Bowerly as Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Senator Ress moves that the Senate Tax Committee recommend confirmation of Cynthia Bowerly as Commissioner of Department of Revenue. Anything else, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Recommendation for confirmation to the Senate.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, members.
Members, we've got minutes in our packet that I would like to have approved for February 26, 2015. Has anyone looked at those? Senator Rest moves.
No.
Oops, Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, there is a correction.
Okay.
And I have discussed it with the committee secretary. I was not present last Thursday. I was out of town, so I need to be marked as absent.
Okay.
And she's already making that correction, but if we're going to adopt them, then we should do it with a correction.
Okay, there's a correction. Senator Rest was excused last on the 26th. Anything else? Senator Coonan moves adoption of the minutes, February 26th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes are adopted. Thank you, members. We're going to move on to provision in the governor's budget, or governor's bill to the Senate Tax Committee, Senate File 826. We're going to talk about Article 2. When the commissioner was here earlier talking about the proposal, I indicated that I thought certain provisions needed a little more time and to have conversation about. This is the one I was primarily thinking about. My goal on this is to have a little airing here today. I think it's better to do it here in the full committee as opposed to having a number of meetings, which we can certainly have in the future. But let's have this first one kind of out here and see where we go. What I'd like to do, if it's okay with the committee, is just have the Senate staff walk us through the proposal so we have a little understanding of what's in it. We'll hear from the public testifiers that are here. And then we'll hear from the department. If that's okay, we'll start there. And I'll stay here and let the staff walk us through. So, Mr. Sylvia?
Mr. Chair and members, Article 2 of the governor's bill is a recodification of the railroad valuation statutes. Currently in Minnesota statutes, there's a chapter that concerns the taxation of railroad, but there's also found in administrative rules section that actually concerns the method of valuation that the Department of Revenue is using. And for purposes of just a bit of background for railroad taxation, a distinction is made between operating property and non-operating property of a railroad. And in the governor's article, there were kind of three changes that are being made other than technical changes. In the Minnesota rules, there are a lot of definitions and other technical changes, and those are being moved into statute. So while it looks like there's some significant new definitions, a lot of those are found in Minnesota rules and are simply being put into statute, and subsequently the rules are repealed so that all the language dealing with the taxation evaluation of the railroads are within one statute. But the three notable changes that is being proposed in the article is to expand the definition of what is considered operating property, to include but not limited to roads, locomotives, freight cars, and improvements on leased property. The Department of Revenue has the Commissioner of Revenue has the exclusive jurisdiction to determine what is operating property and what is considered non-operating property. I think it's easier to say that non-operating property is essentially anything that's not operating property, and it's land or elements that is not necessary for the performance of railroad transportation services or any land that's leased or available to lease to a person that's not a railroad company. But for purposes of operating property, the commissioner determines what that is, and they have primary jurisdiction to assess that, whereas non-operating property, the local or county assessor assesses the property as if it were any other commercial industrial property. Both of the valuations, whether they're done by the commissioner or the local county assessor, then added to the local tax base. Another significant change would be to update the methods that the department can use to value the operating property. Currently in Minnesota rules, the department indicated that the methods are somewhat outdated, and they're not able to use, I believe it's the cost approach. And in Article 2, the methods are updated so that they can use the cost, income, or market approach, and then they can weigh each of those approaches. And lastly, kind of related to the additional operating property becoming taxable, is there is a two changes to the state general levy. One is to update and increase the base amount for taxes payable in 2016 and thereafter. And lastly, modifying the apportionment between the state levy paid by commercial industrial property and seasonal rec property from a 95.5 split to a 95.1 and 4.9 split. It's my understanding that the additional allocation would then be paid for by the additional property that would then become taxable under the modification of the expansion of operating property.
Thank you, Mr. Sylvia. I just want to get myself clear on what's going on with regard to the state business property tax levy. The changes there are a result of the addition of value that would be in place because of the modification to the valuation for railroads. So there's an increase in value, and the changes to add that additively to the existing state levy so that everybody else would pay the same. There would just be some additional revenue coming into the state. Is that the way I'm understanding that?
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct. The changes to the state levy would be as a result of the additional property becoming taxable. But it's my understanding that no other property would necessarily pay the increased amount. It would be borne by the additional taxable property.
Okay. And then just one other thing, Mr. Sylvia, if you could. I think I heard you say that most of this language that's in front of us is currently in rule, and now it's being moved to statute. But there must be some provisions here that are additive because of the addition of the rolling stock to the valuation. Can you draw me to where that change occurs?
Mr. Chair and members, that is...
Is that section 14 on page 12?
Let's see, here's my notes. Mr. Chair and members, Section 3 of the bill is the definition of operating property. And in that section is where the modification is being made to include rolling stock. The way it's written is to include without limitation roads, locomotives, freight cars, and improvements on leased property.
Thank you. Okay, so members, on page 9, Section 3. Any questions of Mr. Sylvia, members? Seeing none, we will go to testimony, and we will start with Mr. Vincent and Mr. Wagner. I hope I didn't mispronounce those names too much. Welcome, gentlemen. Mr. Vincent or Mr. Wagner, whoever would like to start first.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Alec Vincent, and I'm the Assistant Vice President of Tax from BNSF Railway Company. And I come up here today from Fort Worth to speak to you in opposition to Article 2 of Senate File 826 because it illegally targets the taxation of railroad personal property and unfairly targets the valuation of railroad property for purposes of taxation under the guise of modernization. The bill proposes to include railroad personal property, such as locomotives and freight cars, as we just heard, and other work equipment and other personal property, in the property tax base while continuing to exempt all other commercial and industrial personal property from the base. This is discriminatory treatment and has been determined by numerous federal courts to be a violation of Section 306 of the Railroad Revitalization and Regulatory Reform Act of 1976, which I'll subsequently refer to as the 4R Act. More specific to the state of Minnesota, the U.S. 8th Circuit Court of Appeals, as well as the U.S. District Court of Minnesota, have ruled on a number of occasions that taxing railroad personal property, such as what I just described, where commercial and industrial property is generally exempt from personal property, is a direct violation of the 4R Act. The certainty of this result was summarized by Judge Rosenbaum in Burlington Northern Railroad Company versus James in 1983, where I quote, "There is no doubt that Section 306 of the 4R Act requires that BN's personal property be exempt from taxation, given Minnesota's exemption of other commercial and industrial taxpayer personal property." Furthermore, in that same case, the Minnesota Department of Revenue recognized this result and, along with Burlington Northern, stipulated that, and I quote, "Under Minnesota law, virtually all personal property, including commercial and industrial personal property, has been exempted from ad valorem taxation. For purposes of this action, the parties agree that Section 306 requires that the personal property of railroads such as BN will likewise be exempt from taxation." And to be clear, the 4R Act essentially provides that railroad personal property must be simply treated like all other business personal property. The question as to whether to tax personal property is or not is a policy question that you do as a legislature. And here in the state of Minnesota, you've answered that question by exempting business personal property from taxation. Therefore, under the 4R Act, the federal law simply requires that railroad property be subject to the same treatment as all other business property. And I emphasize this point simply because we think this is a direct violation of federal law. We have litigated this issue in other jurisdictions, and it's always been upheld on these set of facts. And when we go into federal court, we seek an injunction to enjoin the collection of illegally, what we believe to be illegal taxes, and that not only causes uncertainty and consternation for us as a taxpayer, but also messes with state and local budgets as well. So I think that's something that needs to be carefully considered. If you find it helpful, I've got my prepared testimony I was going to hand out, and we have a list of cases for your, if you think it would be useful for your reference as well on that. Moving on, in regard to the purpose of modernization or modernizing the valuation of railroad property taxation, the governor's proposal rationalized modernization along the lines of to align the procedures of the state of Minnesota with current property tax laws and the procedures of other states. I submit that the proposed legislation would put Minnesota out of step with most other states that value railroad property for taxes. Article 2 proposes to codify into statute only the appraisal methodologies used for railroad property and modifies the existing valuation framework for railroad property to introduce simplified appraisal concepts not relied upon by any other state to value railroad property. Under the proposed bill, only the appraisal methodologies, like I said, for railroad property would be codified into statute, while the methodologies used for all other commercial, industrial, and utility taxpayers would remain within the existing regulatory framework. In most states, appraisal methods used to value railroads or any other taxpayer, if they're expressed at all, are expressed in the regulatory area with a rules-making process, not codified in statute. I submit that the Department of Revenue's existing rulemaking process, rather than the legislative process, is the most appropriate venue to address proposed changes to the valuation and assessment of railroad property. The existing rulemaking process takes advantage of the specialized expertise and the competency of the Department of Revenue staff and allows for public input and transparency in that discussion through a rulemaking process. And the existing rulemaking process works. There's nothing broken to fix. For example, the Department of Revenue successfully completed comprehensive changes to the administrative rules on the valuation of electric utility property in 2007 and updated some definitions in the rules for railroads in 2004. So to the extent there are concerns expressed about the rules and the methods and the applications of railroad property, we feel that the venue for that discussion can take place in the existing rulemaking process, and we are willing participants in that as well. The proposed legislation also introduces several concepts that apparently attempt to reduce complicated appraisal questions into simple solutions. Unfortunately, such attempts can lend themselves to being incorrectly applied, which can result in incorrect determinations of value and lead to litigation. And for an example, the proposed use of a direct capitalization approach to value reduces the complicated questions around an existing property's future ability to generate income, mitigate risk, and grow into a single income input that is then divided by a capitalization rate. Although it's not clear in the statute how such a capitalization rate would be derived, applications of this approach in other jurisdictions, where we've seen some consideration, have attempted to derive it from stock market data, having little to do with the tangible property subject to taxation here in the state of Minnesota. In other words, this would be like determining the taxable value of a farm using the stock prices of large publicly traded ag companies. Another example would be the bill's proposal to define book depreciation, which is a measure, as you know, of cost recovery associated or dictated by generally accepted accounting principles, as an appropriate measure of all forms of appraisal obsolescence, physical, functional, and economic. This attempt to simplify reduces a very complex appraisal question to a single number reported for an entirely different purpose. This would be like determining the value of your house using only its age, but ignoring its square footage and its location. I am not aware of any state in which the direct capitalization approach, as described above, or book depreciation, is relied upon to determine the value of railroad property for taxation, which again calls into question the need to rationalize or need to modernize under the rationale that the need is based upon the need to align the procedures of the state of Minnesota with all other states.
They must be trying this too.
For these reasons, we respectfully ask you to oppose Article 2 of Senate File 826. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vincent. Before we go to the other testifier, could you just briefly, I mean, from my understanding of some of this personal property tax debate, differing states deal with their personal property tax differently. And Minnesota does have personal property tax on utilities. And, you know, the railroads and the utilities have a comparable purpose. And just could you talk about that a little bit? Because I think, you know, as with all of these issues, there's differing legal opinions that get sorted out. And that appears to be one of the points that has been contemplated. And I'd be curious to hear what your reaction is.
Sure. And that question and what you've described, if I understand correctly, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is the case here in Minnesota where there is a personal property exemption generally for C&I property or commercial industrial taxpayers, but you do tax the personal property of utilities such as electrics and pipelines, and I think airline property as well.
Right.
So based upon that, under that paradigm, that question has been asked and answered as well, most recently in a case, Ogilvie versus State Board of Equalization up in North Dakota, and where it had the same set of facts where it was still ruled to be a violation of the 4R Act. The comparison class generally under those type of cases is with all other commercial industrial taxpayers. And when you have a general exemption and then you have a general exemption for taxpayers, but then carve out and tax certain elements, small elements of that, then under that paradigm, the courts have still upheld that it is a direct violation of the 4R Act. I don't know if that helps your understanding or not.
What I wanted to hear from you. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else, members? Any questions? Before we go to the next testifier, welcome.
excuse me.
Mr. And I apologize for mispronouncing your name, Wagner.
Yeah, Mark Wagner, President, Twin City and Western Railroad Company, headquartered in Glencoe, Minnesota. Mr. Chair, committee, thank you for hearing me today. I started with the Twin City and Western Railroad back in 1991 as their accountant, and as part of my role as accountant was to prepare the property tax returns for our railroad. And it was a learning process because the Department of Revenue has very good staff to work with, and were very helpful in getting us started. But basically, there's three elements that the current rule takes into account when determining the value of our property. One is the physical operating property, and operating property being all that is needed to operate the railroad. Also, it takes into account the what our locomotives and cars are. And then the third is a rolling five-year operating income that they put together, and they say, okay, this is the value of your transportation corridor in Minnesota. And then they allocate that value amongst all the counties that we operate in, and those in turn are assessed to the parcels. And it, to me, it's always been a fair and reasonable way to value our property. The proposal that's before you appears to add, well, it will add to our property taxes. And as a short line railroad, we don't have a lot of margin for error. The earnings that we do get from our freight movements are in turn reinvested in our track. We currently are under some very onerous federal requirements as a result of recent industrial accidents not involving us. But federal legislation, I mean, we're going to be spending millions of dollars that we don't know where it's going to come from. And so now with this additional proposed property tax burden, there gets to a point where you say, I'm not sure we can operate anymore. And I think this is a wrong idea with a wrong focus. I think the current system has worked quite well. We have a very good relationship with the counties and cities we operate through. And so I think this is trying to change something that isn't broke.
Thank you. Questions, members? Thank you. Ms. Cadoon?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Cadoon, welcome to the committee.
Members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm here to state our opposition to Article 2 of the Governor's Tax Bill. We do have concern over the litigation risk that is in this bill, and you've heard from the previous testimony regarding the Federal 4R Act. We think that litigation is real. We think the ability of the state to be able to tax the railroad properties that are being proposed here is questionable, and because of that, we think there is great likelihood of the shifting that would occur to the other business property taxpayers in the state. This bill, as written, does increase the statewide levy by $32 million. If litigation does not prevail for the state, that tax would be shifted onto other business property taxpayers. Minnesota already opposes a fairly heavy tax burden on our business property taxpayers. We're in the top five for most business property taxes when you compare with the other 50 states. We're second highest in rural Minnesota on both commercial and industrial. We also have concerns regarding the uncertainty that this bill would create, not only for the state, just with that general fund implication, but also with the local governments. And we think that also has potential to shift at the local property tax level. Thank you.
Ms. Cadoon, my hearing isn't as good as it could be. I didn't hear all of what you said about the shift. But from my understanding, if we add value into the local units, it will reduce the property taxes for everybody else unless they change their levy. So I'm curious how the shift to the increase is occurring.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the shift occurs regarding the litigation risk. So if you're, for example, in the statewide business property tax, you're increasing the levy by $32 million. If the state does not prevail, that $32 million is still in current law, and that the result would be that would be shifted onto other business property taxpayers in the state.
Okay. But at the local level, there would be a pretty significant offsetting reduction to all properties because of the value that would be added to their base if there's no levy changes.
Mr. Chair, at the local level, I agree if you increase values, that can result in reducing taxes for their property taxpayers. The question is then what happens with the levies if they use that to increase their spending. If the state ultimately does not prevail, once again, you have that increased spending and you do not have that valuation increase that the local governments were relying on. And so you would then have shifting to other local property taxpayers.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Questions, members? Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Cadoon, are you aware of any instance since 1860 when the railroads did not prevail in litigation with regard to state government or local government?
Ms. Cadoon.
Even one instance.
Ms. Cadoon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I certainly have not researched back to 1860 regarding the railroad case law. So I cannot properly answer that question.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazalka.
I figured Senator Ress probably knew the answer, but it's probably that they've always prevailed.
Anything else, members? Thank you, Ms. Cadoon.
Thank you.
DOR. Welcome, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cynthia Bowerly, and with me today and Ms. John Van Nurden in our property tax division, and he and I will be providing you some additional detail and answer any questions that you may have about this proposal. Thank you for this opportunity to discuss in greater detail the governor's proposal with respect to rail property assessment. Currently, Minnesota law requires property to be assessed at market value. Our current railroad rules, however, do not provide for an accurate determination of the market value of railroad operating property. This proposal would set forth in statute the use of modern, generally accepted appraisal practice to estimate market value for railroads, update obsolete language, and reduce the burden of resources spent on this outdated appraisal methodology at the department. Mr. Chairman and members, this proposal would also expand taxable property of railroads to include property like rolling stock and increase the commercial industrial proportion of the state levy. And I would just like to note that this is the portion of this proposal that brings us closer to what other states are doing. A number of other states do include rolling stock in the operating property, and some personal property is already included of railroads. Wharfs and docks are explicitly identified as personal property that is included already in that taxable property, and this proposal would bring additional operating property into that assessment. I'd like to provide the committee with some historical perspective. In 1979, the gross earnings on tax on railroads was eliminated and replaced with an ad valorem tax. Rules adopted were effective for 1979 and subsequent years, and they are substantially the same as they are now. Mr. Wagner noted that when he started with his railroad, that he was the accountant and worked with the department on them on their assessment and valuation, and those rules are essentially the same as they were in the early 90s. We did make some technical changes in 2004 through an expedited rulemaking process. But at this point, the proposal is bringing the changes to the legislature and making a proposal to statutory change. We think this process is fully appropriate for the legislature, and this is a policy decision that we think the legislature should make at this point in time. The methodologies that are in the proposal are trying to bring Minnesota's current rule to up to date with some of generally accepted appraisal practices. In preparing for this proposal, professionals like Mr. Van Nurden at the Department of Revenue reviewed national and international standards and best practices for assessing. They reviewed general appraisal practices from the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice, assessment practices from the International Association of Assessing Officers, methods for centrally assessed property models from the Western States Association of Tax Administrators, unitary valuation standards from the National Conference of Unit Valuation States, and definitions and terms from the Uniform System of Accounts as referenced by the Surface Transportation Board's forms. So we looked at these standards and comparing them to what Minnesota currently has in regulation, found that ours were out of date and we needed to provide a method for Minnesota's assessment and appraisal and equalization process to get us to market value as required by the statute. I would now like to ask Mr. Van Nurden from the Department's Property Tax Division to provide additional information about the valuation method under current law and the benefits that would result from this proposal.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Van Nurden?
Nurden, correct. Mr. Chair, members, I'm John Van Nurden from the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'm the State Assessed Property Supervisor.
Could you speak up just a minute or pull the mic in a little bit?
Of course. Sorry, is this better? Again, I am John Van Nurden. I'm the State Assessed Property Supervisor at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Regarding the current methodology for railroad appraisal, which are generally outlined in Minnesota Rules 8106. Over time, that these rules have become outdated and they are quite rigid. So I'll give you some examples of what's in the current rule. For the cost approach, which is a historical costless depreciation method, there is what is called the blue chip method or Wisconsin blue chip method, which is no longer even used in Wisconsin, which is an obsolete and not generally accepted calculation used to reduce the historical costless depreciation or net book value, also called fair market value by accountants, by subtracting an additional amount for economic or external obsolescence. This deduction amount is calculated by comparing a mixture of various economic, quality, and efficiency factors among the top companies, and then in each category, the company with the best statistic is the standard, and the other companies are measured to have obsolescence in the proportion to the difference between the subject statistic and the best statistic. And this is a discredited method. For the income approach, within the rule is a specific...
Just excuse me for a second. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I interrupt and just ask for clarification?
Senator Dietzick.
And you might be getting next on the income. So I'm trying to follow that blue chip rate of return. So
Could I ask everybody to speak up a little bit?
If I'm hearing you right, and I don't know if I am, so you take the top... whatever, the top railroads, is it their income or their top something, and then that's the standard, and so if somebody else doesn't do as good as that as they do, they get that, they get some deduction from that. And is that kind of like an income tax? So if my income tax is less than my neighbor's, my property tax should be less. I'm trying to figure out where that came from and how, you know, just like a something in, you know, rather than up here, down here, what I can compare it to.
Mr. Van Dorn.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, that is correct. That it is a comparison for the top company in each category to every other company. So categories include such thing as gross revenues and freight traffic density. So the top railroad in each category is the difference is measured between how well they did versus how well every other company did. And the percentage of that is essentially a reduction to their book value for purposes of this approach.
To the blue chip to the top company's deduction, or to everybody else's?
To everyone else's.
Okay.
And as it happens, no company is the best at everything, so every company receives some kind of deduction for this.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Van Nurden, Wisconsin doesn't even use this blue chip method anymore, as you said, but how many other states do use this particular method in assessment?
Mr. Van Nurden.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, to my knowledge, no other states currently use the blue chip method.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson.
Were you done testifying? Because I'll wait.
No, he's going to continue on.
All right, I'll wait till he's done.
Okay, continue on, Mr. Banner.
Thank you. For the income approach, there is a specific model which is also outlined within the rule, which is what is called a no-growth yield capitalization model, which uses the previous 5 years of net operating income to average out and forecast what the income streams will be into forever into the future. This is generally a mismatch for any company that has any sort of change, if they have growth or decline or any other change in their operating plan, which all do. And that rate is then divided by the yield capitalization rate, which is completed using market data. This kind of model requires many assumptions, including that the income from 5 years ago is just as relevant as the income from the previous year for determining what the future income of the company will be. Also, that there's no growth or decline in the company and no growth or decline in the income streams into perpetuity. These assumptions are never true, and all evidence is to the contrary in the market. This proposal will allow us to use the best information available and that's supported by the market evidence in generally accepted income models, including discounted cash flows, stable growth yield capitalization, and direct capitalization. Next, the market approach. Within the rule, it's a prescribed stock and debt model. The most commonly used market value model, which is not just used for commercial industrial property, it's used for residential sales as well. It's through comparison of sales of like property. Under the current rule, the sales of railroads cannot be used to determine the market value of another railroad. Not being able to consider the sales comparison method cuts to the heart of our ad valorem tax system. For comparison, can you imagine trying to figure out the value of your home if you couldn't compare it to the sale prices of similar homes in the area? That is not allowed under the current rule. Finally, the prescribed weightings of those, the cost, income, and market approaches create an artificial and potentially inaccurate market value. Under the current law, the unit value is determined by taking the weighted average of these three approaches, the cost approach at 15%, the income approach at 60%, and the market approach at 25%.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Could you repeat those three methods again and what percent they are? I could not hear that.
Of course.
Mr. Van Nurden.
Senator Scoy, Senator Nelson. The cost approach is 15%. The income approach is 60%.
16 or 60?
60.
60, mm-hmm.
And the market approach at 25% weight.
Thank you.
And members, feel free to interrupt and ask questions. I'm thinking that I'm going to request that you would provide your testimony in written form so we can review it in a little more long term than we will have today, if that would be okay, to the committee.
Of course.
Continue, Mr. Van Nurden.
Okay. So these prescribed weights apply for every railroad and are not a good indicator of market value and do not allow the actual market evidence to be weighed and considered. For example, if we do have evidence that one of those approaches is inaccurate, or if we have insufficient data to calculate one of those approaches, we should put less weight onto that factor. The current rule does not allow us to do that. Under the proposal and in general, again, we are charged with arriving at market value, and there are three generally accepted approaches to do so, the cost approach, the income approach, and the market approach. And there are various models within each of these three approaches that may be more or less applicable for any particular appraisal. The proposal is to provide that the commissioner may use these generally accepted appraisal and assessment practices for estimating the market value for railroads as for other commercial industrial property. Because railroad property operates together as a system and crosses multiple jurisdictions, they are centrally assessed using unitary valuation. Further, because of the more sophisticated nature of the record keeping and financial reporting of these large operating systems, more detailed models can be used. For the cost approach, the proposal will enable the department to consider the published fair market value of the assets, which is available to and reviewed by auditors, investors, regulators, and the general public without an additional reduction in value. According to accounting standards, if the company believes that the value of the assets is too high, it must perform an analysis and write down the value of those assets if it finds that that is the case. This model is accepted for central assessment by the standards of the National Conference of Unit Valuation States. This proposal would also allow us to use other cost approaches, such as the replacement cost model, which is commonly used in appraisals but is generally cost and time prohibitive for use in unitary valuation for large operating systems. For the income approach, this proposal will enable the commissioner to use the best available information, which is supported by market evidence, in the most applicable income models. The most commonly used income models in valuation for commercial industrial property are discounted cash flows, where the explicit forecasts of anticipated future cash flows are discounted to the present value. This discount generally grows exponentially into the future. Then because the explicit forecasts are only typically made for a limited period of time, such as 5 to 10 years, after this period, the forecasts or analysts are forced to default to using a stable long-term market growth rate for cash flows into perpetuity. So if no forecasts are available, or if the forecasts show that the income and cash flows are already growing at the stable long-term rate, then the model can be shortened and simplified to what is called stable growth yield capitalization. The existing income model that is prescribed is a no-growth yield capitalization model, which requires many assumptions that are not supported by market evidence, notably that it assumes that the long-term growth rate of the market is 0% and that net cash flows are exactly equal to net operating income. Also used is direct capitalization, which is commonly used for commercial industrial appraisal. In its most sophisticated form, uses the relationship between net operating income and price from market observations of comparable property, and it applies it to the net operating income of the company being appraised. For some other types of commercial property where record keeping may not be as complete, other models such as gross rent multiplier or gross income multiplier are also accepted, but are not necessary when it is possible to use net operating income for direct capitalization. For the market approach, again, the rule states that there is only the stock and debt model and does not allow the use of the sales comparison approach or model. This proposal would enable us to use that most commonly used market approach. Final in the reconciliation, this proposal eliminates those prescribed weightings and allows us to consider the evidence and availability of the data that is actually used for that particular assessment in weighing the applicability of those models in the actual market value for any particular appraisal.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Artman.
Sir, and to that last point, do you think maybe that gives the department too much discretion at the end there to balance it out and come up with the outcome that they would like?
Mr. Van Dorn.
Mr. Chair, Senator Artman, the result that the department would like is to arrive at market value, and we can do that the same as every other assessor in the state for the counties and local assessors by considering the market evidence.
Chair, well, I thought the whole purpose was to try and quantify market value, and now you're saying the department can impose that valuation at the end. After considering all these factors, they can still adjust them all out. If you would just read back what you just said, that last passage, that's what I'm concerned about.
Mr. Van Dorn, could you repeat that last passage, please?
Regarding the final reconciliation, mm-hmm. It eliminates the prescribed reconciliation weightings and allows the commissioner to evaluate the quantity and quality of the data as well as the applicability of the model for each valuation. If a model does not have sufficient evidence to be reliable, it does not need to be used.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I think one of the challenges that we have seen under the prescribed weighting approach is if there is simply no information about one of the approaches, we're still required to prescribe 25% weight to something that we don't have information about. And so what Mr. Van Nurden is describing is that if there is insufficient evidence or information about one of those weighting factors, the other factors will be the two things that are weighted, as opposed to prescribing 15 or 25% to something that essentially doesn't exist.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, if that's the case, then I hope that you will put that in writing along with the testimony that you've just given to explain in advance to those that are going to be taxed how those discretionary applications are going to be made at the end, the reconciliations.
And perhaps, Senator Ortman, we'll have to contemplate what the appeals process might be. Yeah, I mean, these are parts of the discussion we're going to have here. So, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this might seem like a little issue, but it's concerning, and that is that as you reread that comment about if there's not enough data that a particular model is reliable, I heard you say it does not need to be used. That is very different than saying it will not be used. So I don't take great comfort in saying that it does not need to be used. If there's something that doesn't have enough data to be reliable, it should not be used. It will not be used. So that just those choice of words gives me great pause here and great concern. No, I just want to make the point that there's a big difference between saying something that doesn't have enough data to be reliable does not need to be used, which is what you said, and what I think most people would think, that is, if there's not enough data for something to be used, it should not be used. It will not be used. There's a big difference in the language.
Okay. Anything else now? Continue.
Just a few final points regarding the next steps once the value is reconciled. That is for the system value. It is then allocated to Minnesota. And then there are deductions that are made for locally assessed and exempt property that may be included within that allocated value. This proposal does simplify that process and make it more transparent so that everyone can see what value is being deducted. Also, the apportionment process will be simplified and more transparent, and the equalization, which is currently described in Minnesota Rule 8106, is not the current standard for the International Association of Assessing Officers, or as is even used for other property of other commercial industrial property within the state of Minnesota. So this proposal will update that language regarding equalization to match what is used for other commercial industrial property. With that, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you very much. Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman and Senators, the proposal, Mr. Van Derden has described some of the aspects that are challenging in the existing rule and what the proposal does with respect to assessment. The proposal also adds operating property to the valuation process to ensure that the department can determine the market value of a railroad. This provision does not impose a new tax on railroads that other commercial industrial properties do not pay. It is updating our law to reflect common industry standards and assessing practices for railroad operating property. The goal of including operating property for railroads, which may include personal property in addition to real property, is to ensure that the department can get to market value as required by statute. As a starting point, under Minnesota Statute 2701, Subdivision 1, all real and personal property in Minnesota is taxable unless exempted by other law. The legislature can, of course, grant exemptions for personal property and can also remove these exemptions. There are almost 100 subdivisions to Minnesota Statute 272.02 granting exemptions to various property, some general, such as Subdivision 4 for public hospitals, some specific as Subdivision 96 for personal property of a specified electric generation facility. Some of these have been later repealed. Examples of current personal property that has not been exempted by law and include flight property, including aircraft, off-flight equipment used in connection with an aircraft, computers and software used in operating, controlling, or regulating aircraft and flight equipment. Personal property, which is part of an electric generating transmission or distribution system or a pipeline system, is not exempted by law. For electric utilities, this includes distribution lines, transformers, transmission lines, poles, substation structures of electric generating machinery, and other machinery. For gas utilities, this includes high-pressure distribution lines and distribution meters, structures, and equipment. For pipelines, this includes pipelines, pumping stations, equipment, structures, and machinery. Similarly, personal property that's not been exempted by law for manufactured homes and seasonal structures, including storage shed, decks, similar removable improvements constructed on the site for manufactured homes, seasonal structures, park trailers, or travel trailer. Another example of property that has not been exempted as personal property is that of railroads, such as docks and wharves, for purposes of property tax. So personal property some personal property tax for railroads is already included in this proposal, would expand that to include rolling stock and other personal property, and this would allow us to ensure that the market value can be achieved as required by statute. This approach is consistent with other states. While states, as Mr. Chairman, you noted, to construct their property tax and exemptions differently, most states do tax the operating property of railroads. According to the International Association of Assessing Officers, a report they released in 2012, a 2012 report released in 2013, in two-thirds of all states, railroads' property are fully taxable. An earlier study from New York State showed that over 80% of states tax rolling stock. I'll ask Mr. Van Dern to share with the committee the importance of including all operating property in a valuation aimed at getting to market value.
Mr. Van Dern.
Thank you, Chair.
Could you pull it in just a little bit? It is really hard to hear in this room.
Because railroads are operating as an integrated system of assets, the valuation of that property using unitary valuation considers the value of all of that operating property working together to function as an operating unit and create this value. It exists because it works together. And because it's unitary valuation, the value that we consider for everything, regardless of jurisdictions, borders, or boundaries, is all of that property. It's not just the land and the tracks and the ballast and the ties, but not this other stuff. It's everything together. So if you have an additional level of removing property from that, it takes away from the overall point of assessing it as what creates the value. It's not fractional valuation, which is typically done for smaller properties, which it may be a single house or a single, say, gas station or hotel, which has value in and of itself. It would be that entire system working together, and then it's allocated to Minnesota, and then other property is taken out. So in the purest form, we are already assessing all of the operating property, and the county assessors would be assessing the non-operating property. It all contributes value.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I did want to just note that the 4R Act has been brought up today, so I just want to make clear that this proposal does not illegally target railroads. What it does is bring it in line with additional personal property, as is the case with electric generation, gas distribution, and pipelines. And as the chairman noted, those would be comparable to railroads. There is in the all other commercial industrial property category for those taxpayers, there is personal property included in that as well with respect to that which is integrated with and permanent nature to the real property that is included. There are other exemptions there as well. As I've noted, existing personal property railroads is already included in the operating property. The 4R Act requires that states do not discriminate against railroads with respect to ratios, tax rates, or other taxes that specifically are applied to railroads, and that is not the case with this proposal. Understand there is a lot of litigation in this area, but we have assessed this proposal carefully and do not believe it violates the 4R Act. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, as you noted, this proposal has the opportunity to provide property tax relief to Minnesotans, both at the statewide levy level, and $19 million in new property revenue available to counties, $12.5 million available to cities, $11.4 million to other taxing jurisdictions like school districts, and additional property tax relief, and $2.2 million available to townships. So this is, of course, important value that should be captured in the way that we assess our property taxes. Mr. Chairman, thank you for providing another opportunity to provide more detail on this bill. We'd be happy to answer any questions, and we look forward to continuing this conversation throughout this session on this bill. I will note that we have had the opportunity to meet with railroads and other interested in parties, and we look forward to continuing that dialogue with them about their questions and their concerns, and we look forward to working on this proposal.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll direct these questions to either of the testifiers. The 1976 Act that we're talking about was enacted by the United States Congress basically in response to the bankruptcy of the Penn Central Railroad. It did two things. Well, it did a lot of things, because most federal statutes do. But the big ones were it created some additional levels of competitive market within railroad, and it gave railroads some protections from actions by states to do exactly what Mr. Wegner testified to. So it seems to me what we're doing here today is we're imposing a burden on railroads that may do the exact kind of thing that the 1976 Act was created to prevent. And Ms. Bowerly, you indicated you believe this doesn't violate the 76 Act. I'd like to know of any Supreme Court case or federal case at all that allows this kind of mechanism. Then secondly, the second question I'd have with respect to the valuation method. If you brought a normal person in here off the street to listen to what was being said in here, they would think that they are on Mars. And I can tell you right now, based on Mr. Vincent's testimony and based on what I've heard, the day this becomes law, some railroad is going to be in court challenging it as being unconstitutional. Now, I realize with respect to a tax law, there's not a high level of scrutiny. It only has to pass a rational basis test. But the discretion that is built in for the commissioner that Senator Ortman pointed out in and of itself would likely invalidate this. So I'm not saying how the outcome of the case would be, but to think that there would not be significant litigation over this is a fantasy. Am I wrong?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, if I can answer your last question, which is, are you wrong about litigation? I don't think you're wrong, because on Tuesday, some of the railroads did tell us that they would challenge the statute. So I think you're right.
And for the record, I have not been told that. That's my own conclusion.
So I... So your question about are there any federal cases? In fact, yesterday the United States Supreme Court decided Alabama versus CSX. And in that case, the court noted that the 11th Circuit properly concluded that CSX, the railroad, in that instance, competitors are appropriate comparison class, but that all general and commercial industry properties may also be appropriate comparison class when considering the 4R Act. And so I think what Minnesota has already done in terms of exempting certain personal property and not other personal property provides experience in Minnesota that this is not targeting railroads in a new way. In fact, existing personal property of railroads is included. And for electric generation, gas distribution, pipeline distribution, their personal property is included in their tax base. So I apologize, Senator Thompson, the specific question on assessing methods, was there something you wanted from Mr. Van Nerden, or was that a note that it is a highly technical area of the law?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Bowerly, my point was that the level of complexity itself and the fact that the department, if I understood the testimony correctly, is essentially acknowledged they're seeking to find a way from GAAP, from generally accepted accounting principles, to do this, combined with Mr. Vincent's testimony that it's not rational, will lead us to all kinds of litigation and problems that it seems to me don't make sense in this instance. So, no, I wasn't really looking for an answer.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, and to follow up, a conclusion that maybe Senator Thompson doesn't draw, but I question whether the purpose is to raise revenue or whether to tax these entities fairly. And I haven't come to a conclusion based on what I heard today. I'm still concerned that it might be the former. I'm not convinced that it's not.
Okay. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, this proposal is aimed at giving the department the capacity to assess, appraise, and equalize this type of property in a way that makes sense to get us to what the statute requires us to, is the market value. And if I could just ask Mr. Van Durden, because it is him, it is his work and that of his team, and they have the detailed and experience with the challenges of the existing approach.
Mr. Van Durden.
Mr. Chair, members, the methodology that we'll be using is generally accepted appraisal principles that are used in all other property valuation. It does get a little bit more technical because it's dealing with larger operating systems through unitary valuation, but these are not methods that are foreign to those outside of the assessment community. They're standard, and they're also used for other commercial industrial property within the state. The discounted cash flows and yield capitalization, they may be complicated, but they're standard approaches that are used. Same with the cost approaches. The fair market value is on their corporate books, and the replacement cost are also standard models that you'll see in unitary valuation and other appraisals.
Tenor.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, are there any other states that apply this standard that isn't currently embroiled in litigation about the standard?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I'd have to do some research on that. I've not prepared for that today.
Okay. Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify? Senator Sanger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to either of the witnesses. You know, I'm sitting here, kind of thinking, our tax board's been around for a while, and maybe to some degree to Senator Ortman's question, what is this about? This issue has probably been sitting there for a good many years through many administrations. I guess the question is why now? Why is this before us now? And in particular, given its contentiousness.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Senjum, the department has been looking at issues with respect to property valuation and assessment and appraisal practices, and there are a number of different categories, as you are aware. I believe it was in 2007 that we completed a significant rulemaking with respect to utilities. We spent, as you are all aware, last legislative session looking at through the lens of an unsession to try to reduce and repeal outdated statutes and reduce the number of components in the tax provision. We have been focusing in certain areas, and we've been trying to take a methodological approach to getting through the many different areas in property tax. And, of course, at the same time that these professionals are trying to take a review of existing statutes and rules, as we always do every legislative session, to provide you all with our thoughts on how that might be best accomplished. They are also administering this tax system, and so that is a part of their job as well. So the timing is based on when we, frankly, had a proposal that we thought was well thought out enough and developed enough for the governor to present to the legislature.
Okay.
Mr. Vincent, a couple quick comments. You can stay where you're at, Commissioner. Mr. Vincent.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman and Senators. I would like to just rebut a couple of comments or reemphasize my prior testimony. And during Mr. Van Nerden's testimony, he went into great length to describe the technical and complicated nature of appraising complicated properties like railroads. And again, the current state law here in Minnesota is to determine the market value of railroad property like it is for all other taxpayers. And also consistent with other property taxpayers, it's to use generally accepted appraisal principles, and that's in the law. And that's consistent with many states. Then the Department of Revenue, like many states, has been charged to execute that state law, and they do it through rules and have done it through rules apparently since 1979. And we believe still, given the complicated technical nature of the beast, that's where discussions around concerns about antiquated rules or changes to the rules or application of those rules to different types of property taxpayers is the best venue. And again, that's the point of my testimony on that. There are parts of the rules, as Mr. Van Derden described, that we would probably agree need to be changed, and to use that rules-making process is the appropriate place. And when the governor's proposal, they referenced a 2011 study to be the genesis of this concern of changes. And the rules process would allow us to participate in that conversation because we have yet to see the 2011 study. And again, I'll just end with the comment that we believe, again, the rules-making process lends itself so well to that. And you have the governing statute, you have implementation of the rules process. One other final comment is the commissioner referenced a recent Supreme Court case, and just want to clarify, and we can add that to the list as well, but it's a sales and use tax case in the state of Alabama. It had nothing to do with property tax cases. And so it's a completely different type of application.
Sir Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to go back to the commissioner. I had actually looked at that Alabama CSX case. I refreshed myself a little. The reason that they won coming back up here this month, having lost that case originally a while ago, is that it was determined that the state of Alabama had applied the tax to similarly to other motor carriers. Now, you've referenced a laundry list of other businesses that pay this tax. However, the U.S. Supreme Court in this Alabama case specifically said that's not the measure. The measure is the railroad's competitors. So my question is, do other motor carriers and competitors of the railroads pay this tax in Minnesota?
Commissioner Bauer.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Thompson, I think we would, depending on the product that's being transported, I think pipelines are also a competitor, particularly with the Bakken oil coming through on rail. I think that what the Supreme Court was looking at was competitors and people in the class, or not only the limit, but competitors are most appropriate, are another appropriate place to look.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, to any of the three of you, Mr. Vincent, are you aware of any case at any time where a court has said a pipeline is a competitor of the railroad for the purposes of applying tax policy?
Senator Thompson, I think you could also ask about planes because they are personal property tax also, and I think they're transporting things also. But whoever would want to answer, Mr. Vincent, Commissioner?
Yeah, I guess my experience has been in the property tax arena, and under the property tax application, the 4-Act, the comparison class is all other CNI property. The specialized case in reference to competitors is applied in sales and use tax cases, which is not an issue here.
Anything else, members? Anyone else? Thank you very much. I really appreciate the focus on the issue at hand, and this was a good discussion. Members, I just want to briefly say here that I know this is a complicated valuation issue that we're working on now, but in my years as a county commissioner, school board member, valuation is what really drives a lot of the complaints that we have with regard to property taxes. And, you know, property taxes are not a static thing in Minnesota. We're always updating and working on these things. So this is another one of the things that we're going to work on. Working on electrical generation, we've worked on assessor accreditation for valuation. I think it's important. I appreciate your conversation. I think we're going to have continued discussion about this as we go forward this session. But I have not been one to shy away from these issues. I've carried other of these issues, and sometimes they take longer than one session. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking at this and modernizing our valuation mechanisms, I think, is important. And so I'm happy the commissioner and the governor brought this forward for our contemplation. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree that making sure our valuation process is up to date and fair is important. And it is important work for this committee, for the commissioner, for the entire state. But when the proposal is also generating $90 million over the next 4 years to the state of Minnesota and additional revenue to our local communities, I think there's a higher burden to come forward and show that it's a fair revaluation process. And given the concerns and the questions and the nature of the case law, I think the department would be well advised to take all of that into consideration going forward here. This is very tenuous ground you're on.
Well, Senator Ortman, I expect that that'll be part of the what we're doing for the next few months, and we've got a couple months left, so we'll continue to look at this. Senator Sanjam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think you'd mentioned this earlier. To the extent the witnesses are willing, I as one member would appreciate, you know, a copy of some of the testimony we heard today.
Oh, yes. If you testifiers would be willing to provide us written testimony.
I do have that. I didn't know how to distribute it.
Well, we'll get somebody to come and get it from you. Okay. We appreciate that. We'll have a little further time to review and reflect on what was said here today then. Seeing nothing else, thank you very much, members. Senator Rest, division Monday and Wednesday.
That's correct, 8:30.
Full committee Tuesday and Thursday of next week. Thank you very much. It is adjourned.